Dr. Rick Doblin, welcome to the Opium Den.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here with you.
Well, we know you're getting...
Who brought the opium?
Who brought the opium? Well, I'll tell you what, when you didn't answer the call at 3 o'clock, I smoked the rest of it.
That'll serve me right for being late.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. Well, I know you're busy getting ready for Seder tonight, but I want to thank you for taking the time to speak with us.
Well, it's my pleasure.
Well, great. Well, all our listeners are waiting to hear how your MDMA clinical trials are progressing. But first, I'd like you to share with everyone how you first became acquainted with MDMA and how you came to believe in its therapeutic value.
Well, that's a story I'm happy to relate. It took place in 1982. And I was an undergraduate. I had actually started college in 1971. And I was, you know, a very idealistic person. I was a draft resister. I was expecting to go to jail. And, you know, I wasn't going to run to Canada or anything. I was anticipating going to jail. And I ended up being introduced to LSD. I went to a new college. It's the Honors College of the State of Florida. And it was a private school then. It was experimental, no grades. Everybody had to do a senior thesis. It was very much focused on the student's curiosity is the most important thing. And my curiosity led me to LSD. And my experiences with LSD were more than I could handle, but they were also somehow essential and important and also educational, and it helped me to realize that I was extremely an unbalanced person, overdeveloped intellectually and underdeveloped emotionally. And it seemed like being in school was sort of continuing that overdevelopment intellectually. So I decided I would drop out and try to get better at tripping. And I felt that I had to also get more grounded, get more integrated. And so that process took me 10 years.
Wow.
And I built houses. I took small amounts of LSD now and then to help me work through some of the other experiences that had been more overwhelming before. And so during this 10-year period, I always knew I was going to go back to college and I was going to study to be a psychedelic therapist. And that's informally, in a sense, what I was doing for those 10 years that I was dropped out of. I'm reading books about psychedelics. I was tripping now and then, building up my strength. And after 10 years, I finally was ready to go back to college. And I started where I had gone before, at a new college. And as soon as I was starting to do the planning, I was just really frustrated because there was a workshop with Stan Groff at Esalen, a month-long workshop on the mystical quest. And I was like, damn, I'd really rather be there than at school. And then I figured, hey, this is a new college. I should be able to get credit for off-campus study. And I was able to work that out. So I went to California. During this 10-year period, I had had this sense that just as I was waking up to psychedelics in 71, 72, the research was being shut down. The Controlled Substances Act came in 1970. So I felt like I came on the scene too late. And I thought that it was pretty much destroyed by the laws and the repression, and that research really had been shut down all over the world. And so I was kind of solitary in Sarasota, Florida, and doing my work and reading. And when I went to Esalen, I had this tremendous opportunity to discover that there had been an underground psychedelic culture the whole time. I just had not been aware of it. And that the psychedelic culture had actually focused around therapy, focused around spirituality, and had started exploring MDMA that had been used since the middle 70s, that by the time I learned about it in 1982, there was hundreds of psychiatrists and therapists working with it all over the country under the code name ADAM, and doing it in a way that was quiet and wasn't attracting the attention of the media or the DEA or anything like that. And when I first saw it, though, I was really underwhelmed. I mean, I was told about it in terms of people communicating better, feeling happy, things like that. And I was like, well, I think I can communicate pretty fine, and I already feel happy. And, you know, I saw a couple people taking it. It didn't seem dramatic the way LSD or psilocybin or mescaline seems dramatic. You know, they were able to carry on a conversation. And so I really, from the outside in, I missed the profound subtleties of it. But I decided I would take some home and do it with my girlfriend when I got back home. And when we did that, it was just tremendous. It felt like liberating deeper levels of love that didn't feel like they were artificial or from the drug. The drug opened us up to levels inside ourselves that were real and genuine. And it was a profound experience for me. And the fact that it was legal, and I had learned also that there was already starting to be people marketing it as ecstasy. There was already a public scene that was developing with it, which meant that inevitably it would be criminalized. So this time now I had a sense that I wasn't behind the times, that I was actually a little bit ahead of the times, and that we could predict that since we were still in the midst of a raging drug war, and, you know, we still are now.
Yeah, some things never change.
Well, the Rockefeller drug laws have just ended in New York. Things are changing.
True.
In a really good way. And, you know, it's slow and it's gradual, but it's picking up momentum. So I feel that the hard, compassionless, culture warrior, symbolic politics doesn't carry the day as much as it did before. And so I think it's a real time of potential, of opportunity, and that if we can approach it incrementally, carefully, that we're not going to have the backlash that we had in the 60s. That's, you know, we have the lessons of the 60s. We saw you go too far too fast and society freaks out and strikes back. And also you self-define as a counterculture and you just generate massive fear and pressure.
Well, that's so true. And I'm sorry to interrupt you there, but you were saying about your inner discovery on your first experiences with MDMA. Is that what led you to believe that there would be a therapeutic value for this substance?
Yes. I mean, I had heard, you know, about, and I had talked to people that had been using it for years in therapy. So, you know, I heard those stories.
And it was your experience that validated those stories and decided and made you decide to move forward in that direction?
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, I also worked with friends who were going through different emotional problems, including one woman who was suicidal. And we worked with MDMA. This was in 84. And it really helped her to come to terms. We did an MDMA session and then an MDMA LSD combination session.
Ooh.
The LSD MDMA combination. The MDMA session was like a survey of the layers of trauma of her life. So it was just so much pain in one life. And then we felt like maybe we'd go to something stronger and that might help her break out of it. And the LSD turned out to be too strong, too powerful, too scary, and so it was all perceived symbolically. She was in a foreign planet, and there was, you know, incredibly hot sun, and she was baking and going to dry up and die, and, you know, but it was all alien and, you know, too much. And what we thought, well, is that maybe if we gave her half a dose of MDMA, that might ground her a little bit, open up her ability to handle the pain.
And was that successful?
That's what happened. We did a half a dose of MDMA, and that led to the breakthrough. And that was, you know, almost 25 years ago. And she's now a therapist. She's worked on MDMA therapy projects. What that did is it turned it from, you know, being on this alien planet to being right after she was raped and beaten up and left out in the hot sun on the ground. And so it turned from symbolic to a memory. The LSD gave her the core feelings of this deep trauma, but it was too much. And the MDMA helped her to integrate it and to personalize it and to then look at it. The breakthrough actually was when she started talking about this guy that had raped her and that it was a date rape situation. And she had trusted this guy. And I asked her, well, you know, well, what did you like about him? And as soon as I said that, she just sort of involuntarily threw up.
Yeah.
And because she had part of this connection to suicide was that she could no longer trust herself. You know, she had thought that this guy would be safe, and he turned out to be somebody who brutalized her. And if you can no longer trust yourself to discern, you know, in the search for love, then there's really in your mind the hope that you're going to find it. And so that sort of leads to this sense, well, then might as well commit suicide. And so to start differentiating, again, to start trusting her judgment, to look at this guy had liked animals. And so she was able to sort of say, well, that doesn't necessarily mean that it's a person that will be kind to people. So
well,
she started gaining her capacity again.
Well, I'm glad that that happened for her, and I'm glad to hear that she's doing well. So let's fast forward and tell all of our listeners what's going on in Israel with your MDMA clinical trials.
Yeah. Well, to back off a little bit further, what we're doing, MAPS is basically a non-MAPS multidisciplinary association for psychedelic studies.
Say that when you're stoned.
Yeah, it's the I've been teased for it being the nonprofit with the most syllables in its name in the drug reform movement. And so we say MAPS for short. In a way, it's to provide kind of intellectual, emotional maps to consciousness. And we're basically a nonprofit psychedelic and medical marijuana pharmaceutical company. And so our goal is to develop credible scientific research approved by regulatory agencies using standardized outcome measures operating to the same or higher as levels as the basic pharmaceutical industry. So our first study with MDMA for post-traumatic stress concluded in September last year in the United States. And that was 21 subjects, took us 4 years and $1 million. And we have two veterans from the Iraq War. Most are people, women with sexual assault. And the results are outstanding. And we work with people. They have to have failed on both pharmacotherapy. The only drugs that are approved by the FDA for PTSD are Zoloft and Paxil, SSRIs. So people have to have failed on SSRIs, meaning that they had them, but it didn't give them enough relief. And then they have to have failed on a limited number of different kinds of psychotherapy that have been shown to be effective for PTSD.
Now, do you think that's legitimate, or do you think those are roadblocks that are placed in your way on your research quest?
Well, you know, I think that we had to do that because there was such massive, it's hard to put these words together, but massive scientific propaganda. Put out by the National Institute on Drug Abuse about the neurotoxicity of MDMA. One dose, permanent brain damage, and, oh, of course we don't see it, but, you know, it'll show up 30 years from now. So, manipulated brain scans. I just was writing to a funder today about brain scans that were shown on MTV, 48 Hours, and Oprah. A woman who was a heavy MDMA ecstasy user, also used other drugs, and she was going around the country showing a SPECT scan that looked at cerebral blood flow that showed massive holes throughout her brain. It was a totally manipulated image. So
well, was the image manipulated, but the doctrine behind it wasn't all that sound, because my understanding is that when I think Ricard did his studies, he interviewed people that had, you know, just said they had done MDMA or ecstasy. But there was no way to validate if the drug they did was pure, adulterated, or even contained MDMA at all. So doesn't that tend to invalidate all of those original studies?
Somewhat. I mean, but not completely. I mean, because when you're dealing with studying people who've done illegal drugs, you know, you're always going to be faced with that situation that you don't know exactly what they did, and that a lot of times MDMA ecstasy is mixed with methamphetamine, cocaine, caffeine,
dextromethorphan,
all sorts of stuff.
Yeah.
And so, but you know, it's the best you can do. So, you know, unless you do clinical research. And clinical research through the FDA throughout the 80s was blocked by George Riccardi and others who were trying to claim that it was so dangerous. They knew that it was so dangerous without even doing the research that you couldn't do the research. It was unethical to do the research. So when it came time for the post-traumatic stress disorder study, we needed to design it in such a way so that it would be very difficult for anybody who was trying to do a sincere scientific evaluation of risks and benefits to say no. So by working with people who were treatment failures, who have no options from the traditional medicine, you can accept a higher risk because they're suffering, nothing else is happening, and therefore, because they're in such pain, you know, the risk-benefit ratio is different if they're treatment failures than if they're not. Actually, it turned out to be a tremendous benefit to us because when you work with the worst of the worst, the people that are really, really severe and nothing else has worked for, they tend to be, on the outcome measures, they start out really, really high. So that if you can, if you do have a technique that helps them, you will get substantial drops in their outcome measures, and then your statistics will be better. So that if you work with people that are only mildly post-traumatic stress, you know, how much of a benefit can you get? You know, they already start out, you know, in the middle. You can still do great work, with, and you can still get statistically significant results. But if you happen to have the combination of a treatment that works and a patient population that is severely disabled by whatever their clinical condition is, you know, that's what you want, because then you get the best statistics and you can really demonstrate. So fortunately, MDMA is like that, that it offers such a unique advantage to trained and skilled psychotherapists who know how to help people work through their pain and work through their process, that people who have been stuck for years, in our Israel study, in our Israel study, we just treated someone who's had post-traumatic stress disorder from the Six-Day War in 1967.
Oh, man.
This is over 40 years. And he's doing much better.
Do you attribute that directly to the, do you attribute that directly to the MDMA therapy? Obviously, he hasn't been able to have access to that over the decades, and this is a recent phenomenon for him. Do you believe or do you credit the MDMA for his progress?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, that's the nature of scientific research, where you try to eliminate all the variables but one. So when people are in our study, what we say to them is that if they're on other psychiatric medications, they have to stop. They have to taper off of them. If they're going to a therapist, they should stay with that therapist, but they should not increase or decrease the amount of time that they're seeing them. So we try to make it so that there's no other medications that, you know, could be claimed to have helped. And in fact, you know, when you administer MDMA in combination with a lot of psychiatric medicines, it mutes the effect of the MDMA. So people tend to withdraw from their other medications. The symptoms actually can sometimes get worse, which means that things are coming to the surface. And if you can create a safe, supportive environment around that, that's actually what you want, because then people are motivated to try to work hard and they can't escape, and they're trying to deal with rather than run from. So for this particular person who had had PTSD for over 40 years, it was pretty clear that once we introduced the MDMA assisted psychotherapy program and he started doing better, that it was due to that. Now, you need to do that with large numbers of people.
Well,
and
of course.
You know, you say, so what we're doing now is what's called phase 2 pilot studies. And these are exploratory studies, small numbers of subjects, and you're refining your method of therapy. We're evaluating different doses. We're working on methodology of research to try to figure out how to do a double-blind study. We're looking at side effects. And we're also looking at how, or whether, I should say, we can successfully teach therapy teams to help patients in wildly different cultural contexts. How much of this is universal? How much of this is, you know, peculiar to Americans or Canadians or what? So that the other part of it is that growing up Jewish, growing up in the shadow of the Holocaust, you know, I was raised to see Israel as an important safety mechanism and an important expression of Jewish identity. You don't have to be religious to feel that. It was more of a cultural thing. And
oh, absolutely.
So I was raised to try to make a contribution. And, you know, I was like most kids. I rebelled in Hebrew school. I didn't pay attention. And,
Shame on you.
But I started in the 90s, in the early 90s, thinking that maybe this interest that I was developing in psychedelics could form the basis of a contribution that I could make to Israel.
And, well, I think without question, you are making a contribution not only to Israel, but all of those who suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say that as part of this sort of sense of making a contribution to Israel, that's led to our study in Jordan. So that we're in the protocol approval stage right now at the military hospital in Amman. And it's my goal there to, sponsor this. It's just tremendous. It's the first study with MDMA where documents are translated into Arabic. And it's to try to build communications between the Israeli and the Jordanian psychiatrist and therapist, and then eventually between the Jordanian and Israeli patient. And to try to help heal the trauma of war from both sides of the divide. So it's just very, very important to me. And what happened about 4 weeks ago, a MAPS donor called me up and said that he wanted to make a donation. And, we have an Ibogaine study, Ibogaine in the treatment of opiate addiction in Mexico.
Right. That's a very interesting subject that, as well. Maybe we can do another show on that, but that's a very good thing.
Yeah. And so I talked to him about that. It was a $30,000 study. I had just a week before that, I'd gotten someone to say that he would give a $15,000 matching grant. And so this fellow said that he would match that. He had actually gone to the Ibogaine clinic and for personal growth reasons, and it had helped them a lot. And then he said, well, what else you got? And I'm like, well, the most idealistic, far-fetched, hard to actually succeed at, but maybe the biggest payoff is the study in Jordan that we're trying to start with the Jordanian security forces, army, police, firefighters, stuff like that. And then he said, well, how much does that cost? And I said, well, that whole study will be about $85,000. And it didn't take him more than a second. He's like, well, all right, I'll do that too.
Good for him.
And we were just in Jordan. Mallory Mojeko and Josh Sundstrom and I, they both are part of MAPS's clinical monitoring research team. So we've had people from Novartis, a pharmaceutical company, who've trained our staff in evaluating and monitoring the data so that it will survive critical review by FDA and other regulatory authorities. And so we were in Jordan and doing a site visit, meeting the Jordanian psychiatrist and some of the leading psychiatrists in Jordan. And the donation arrived while we were there in Jordan into our bank account in the U.S. And so we're going to have a training program. We now have these phase two pilot studies. The U.S. one has completed, but we're getting ready to start a new one, small one, just in veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan.
Well, I think
we have studies.
that will be of particular interest to everyone, and perhaps because it's here in the country, we'll get more positive media attention than we're getting now with your studies outside the country.
I think that's true. And, you know, the ironic thing is that in Jordan, there's about 500,000 Iraqi refugees in Jordan, many of them with post-traumatic stress disorder. So we're hoping to enroll some of them. And we've met a young Iraqi psychiatric med student at the University of Jordan, and he's going to try to help us recruit some Iraqi refugees. So on the one hand, we'll be treating Iraqi refugees with PTSD, and on the other, we'll be treating American soldiers who have PTSD from being in Iraq. And, you know, we're treating, you know, Israelis from the different wars. And, you know, there's just an enormous reservoir of trauma and pain that underlies a lot of world and social and country relations. And if we can start trying to tap into that and help people process that and see more clearly and get some hope that they can break the patterns of the past. So we have a study underway in Switzerland that's been going for a couple of years and should finish in a year. We have this Israeli study that's in the early stages, and we've just about a month ago got permission from Health Canada for a study that's going to take place in Vancouver.
Great.
And we're working with a team in Spain to try to get a study funded and up and running by early 2010. So these are our phase two safety and efficacy pilot studies. We anticipate two more years of that. And then we go to the FDA and the European Medicines Agency, and we say, here's our data. Here is how we evaluate the risks. Here's how we evaluate the benefits. Here's the design of the large-scale phase three study. And we need two of those that we would like to do. And if these studies work out, then we want permission to market this drug as a prescription medicine. So you negotiate what the design of the study is based upon your preliminary research in the phase two studies. And we can basically say that, you know, the first study in the U.S., Michael and Annie Mithofer were the male-female co-therapist team, was in 21 subjects. It was a tremendous result. We're going to have about 80 or so subjects in our phase two studies. And then we'll probably need another 600 in order to make MDMA into a medicine. And we're anticipating that will probably take us 10 years from now and $10 million.
Well, that's the question I wanted to address to you next, Rick. Making MDMA a legal and prescribed medication here in the States. Now, you also believe that MDMA has great potential for individuals who are otherwise healthy. And I'm wondering if we were to legalize MDMA as a medicine, as we're trying to legalize marijuana as a medicine, how do you believe those who do not qualify from a medical standpoint to utilize MDMA, how do you think that would become available to, you know, people like me or others who enjoy it on a recreational basis, but also get the same type of result of feeling better about themselves and the world? How do you think that's going to translate to the healthy market?
Okay, that's a super great question.
Well, thank you.
Let me just say that from the time that I was 17 and 18, in 71, 72, where I decided to be an underground psychedelic therapist, and then Jimmy Carter pardoned all the draft resistors, and I could start thinking of, in 76, and I could start thinking of a above-ground career. My effort was going to go to learning how to do psychotherapy and then learning how to do psychotherapy outcome research. In 87, when I finally graduated New College, and I tried to get into clinical psych PhD programs, and I was honest about how I wanted to do MDMA research for my dissertation, despite the fact that I had studied really hard and had good grades on the GREs, good scores and all that, nobody in any of these graduate schools was ready to say yes, to let me in and do that. And that meant that this sort of 16, 17 years that I had been working in this direction had reached an end. And for me, a lot of times when I'm at a dead end, if I smoke some pot and think about what's going on, I can kind of come up with a strategy, or at least an attempted strategy. So what I recognize is that the politics was in the way of the science, and therefore I should switch to study the politics. I want too much too fast, and I need to switch. So I applied and got accepted into the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard, and that's where I got my master's and my PhD. So that was sort of an introduction to say that just like individuals have psychiatric illnesses and pathologies, so do cultures. Cultures can be insane in different ways, and you know, in the grips of fear and paranoia. And so what your question is about is, you know, how do we move from providing medicines to people with designated illnesses in a context where our society is more open to medical use? I mean, that's what we see with marijuana. The medical use of marijuana is being accepted and legalized by states well before non-medical use. How do we move to where a society can acknowledge and accept that these drugs are tools? Their benefits or their harms depend on how they're used. That like a war on drugs is giving all these properties to, it's like giving your own power away. You're sort of saying you're investing, these are evil drugs or these are bad drugs. And so what another part of our work, my work, and this is sort of by talking to you, public education, a big, big part of it, is that I think that a more healthy society, where MAPS is working towards, is precisely what you were asking for, a society that has successfully integrated psychedelics in some form or another for medical use, therapeutic use, religious, spiritual use, personal growth, recreational use, all different forms, and that each of these different kind of contexts carries different kind of risks, different kind of benefits, and we need sort of different social policies to try to, you know, get the best outcomes, and we need to do it in a larger context that respects human rights and says that the fundamental human right is to explore your consciousness. It's prior to the freedom of thought. It's prior to the freedom of speech to experience your own consciousness from different perspectives.
And I agree, and the point that I was trying to make, do you believe that there should be a dual track of research, not just for the medicinal use, but for the recreational use as opposed to recreational use? My fear is that if we take marijuana, MDMA, and even LSD in the study of cluster headaches, if we designate these drugs as medicines only, I see a couple of outcomes. One, we'll have a massive outbreak of illness, people getting sick to get these medicines, or we'll have a continued prohibition against the non-medical use of these substances. So do we need a dual track research here?
Yeah. Well, I don't know that the research track is different, but the time frame. If you can expand your time frame and think about social change as happening in generation segments of, you know, 20, 30, 40 years, so that we are going to have a phased opening in our culture. We are a paranoid culture that has been massively disinformed, misinformed by various interest groups who are some sincere, some just promoting fear in order to, you know, have more jobs at prison. A lot of people like authoritarian states. That where we are, meaning the people trying to look at the beneficial uses of these substances, we are so massively outnumbered and outfinanced that there is hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars, billions of dollars in anti-drug advertising. And that's what the culture is mostly responding to. So how do we counteract that? In our culture, scientific research has currency and gets widely reported in the media. So the research that we're doing with MDMA and post-traumatic stress disorder, we have successfully established that people can take MDMA a couple times in therapy, and there is no observable brain damage.
Oh, absolutely not.
Well, but see, you say absolutely not, right? But there's a lot of people that have heard and believe that MDMA will cause holes in their brain, or MDMA will drain their spinal fluid, or MDMA will cause them to somehow or other be knocked off balance.
Well, fuck them. I mean, well, at a certain point, we have to look at those who are ignoring science and staying with the ideology of prohibition and just laugh at them and say, you know, you're full of shit. We've tried arguments
and we've tried debates. A lot of them don't know that. See, what I'm trying to say is that the research into therapeutic uses and the research into medical marijuana gives us a platform. It's called earned media. You know, I'm not paying you right now to be on the show. You know, I was talking to National Geographic TV. They're doing a special on a special documentary on LSD and psilocybin. And I'm not paying them. They're not paying me. But millions of people are going
to
see.
Do they need any subjects to help them out? I'd volunteer.
Where are you located?
anywhere they want me, Rick. Anywhere they want me.
Yeah. So what I'm thinking is that the work that we do, and this is why do you think medical marijuana is so frightening to the DEA and so frightening to the National Institute on Drug Abuse and to the sort of proponents of the drug war? It's because medical marijuana and the research into marijuana will contribute to delegitimizing the exaggerated risks that the government has been putting out about marijuana for decades and decades.
Well, I think a significant portion of the public doesn't buy into that anymore, and they look at marijuana not as a harmless drug and or a medicinal drug, but I think that they have begun in the past 10 years, at least to my reckoning, they have begun to accept that what basically you and I and many others have been saying all along, that marijuana is not this terrible drug that turns everybody into mass murderers, and they're no longer buying into the Partnership for the Drug Free America, ONDCP, and others who put that out.
Yeah, it's hilarious that you say that, because I just prepared a fundraising package to a man who's been giving large amounts of money to the Partnership for Drug Free America, and that's what I spent a lot of today was showing how the partnership has presented misleading information about the brain damaging effects of MDMA.
Without question, I attended the 20th anniversary gala celebration for the Partnership for a Drug Free America in New York back in 2006. I was the only guy there with an opposing view, but what I found two things quite surreal. Again, Partnership for a Drug Free America, they had an open bar for an hour and a half before the dinner, and the booze flowed freely during the dinner. And the second thing I found unusual is that the man of the year that they chose that best personified the message of the Partnership for a Drug Free America was Bud Selig, the commissioner of Major League Baseball, who was at the time embroiled in the steroid scandal. So I think that a lot of these organizations, whether it be government or private organizations funded by the government, I believe they're paper tigers, and it's time for us to stand up to them and call their bluff, grab them by the lapels or the blouse collars and shake them and say, you know what, you're fucking crazy. You're wrong,
and it's time to stand down. But I think the key is to put yourself in the position of the people who disagree with you. And that's where MDMA is of it. MDMA helps you to listen to the other side. The shadow side of yourself and the other side.
So do you recommend we get all of these drug warriors and drug propagandists and put them in a room and give them MDMA enemas and sit around and hug and kiss and walk out and get better?
No. I think, you know, our fundamental principle is that people should have free choice about what they put into their bodies, and that we should have the choice to say yes or no, and that we shouldn't force it on anybody. And that if they don't want to do it, that's their choice.
Well, I agree. We should not force it upon anyone, but they should not force their ideology on us and prohibit us from doing the things that we feel is right.
Well, they should not, but they are. So we live in a massive police state with a system of prohibition that is becoming slightly less cruel, that people are starting to wake up. And so there's several different tracks. So there's the spiritual track. There's thousands of years of history for peyote, for mushrooms, for drugs like LSD, Etalusis, that these substances, psychedelic substances for ayahuasca from the jungle, for ibogaine from Africa, that psychedelics have been used for thousands of years and have been integrated into cultures in very successful ways. And those cultures tended to be healthier. And that we have a similar vision, that we need to develop a culture that is not so freaked out by psychedelics, that provides an opportunity that integrates the option of psychedelics. So the approach that I think is going to happen is that, you know, the Supreme Court a couple of years ago ruled in favor of an ayahuasca church. They've ruled in favor of the Native American church use of peyote. You know, there is a little bit more growing understanding, particularly ayahuasca has had a major effect. A lot of underground ayahuasca use in the United States outside of these churches. And people are starting to understand that for religious purposes, it's, you know, people normally, you know, high-functioning people in society, not only, but, you know, many, and that they're able to use these drugs to their benefit for personal growth and make contributions to society and keep with their families and keep in their jobs and keep in their, you know, houses of worship and go to the PTA meetings, that you can integrate successfully the use of psychedelics and drugs throughout a lifespan with what from the outside looks like a pretty traditional life.
Well, I agree. I mean, I've been using LSD for 40 years now, and I found it to be a very helpful substance in informing my worldview and keeping me right. And what I'd like to just get to one last question for you is that, or one comment that you can speak to. Recent polls have shown that 76% of American adults believe the drug war has failed. Now, it's true that a number of them believe that we're just not trying hard enough, but a significant majority believe that we should create a regulated market for these drugs, similar to what we have for alcohol and tobacco. So I believe that that our country is moving towards at least the understanding of prohibition being wrong. They may not understand the actual drugs themselves, but they're getting to the, they're getting the idea that prohibition is wrong. So alongside your very important clinical trials with MDMA, ibogaine, LSD, What do you think the non-medical community should do to help emphasize this and feed off the 76% of the people who are beginning to be to realize the drug war is wrong?
Well, I'd say, you know, the key point is incremental change. Don't get impatient. Work with people's fears. Try to understand the fears. Why did prohibition end? What brought about the end of prohibition? Part of it was
broke.
The depression.
I mean, alcohol prohibition ended because primarily we were broke and the government needed the tax revenues, and that's why I'm excited.
Well,
now.
Not really. I mean, I think that it was the violence associated with the prohibition just got out of hand. The glamorization of Al Capone, the gangsters, the speakeasies, the widespread disrespect for law. But the group that was responsible for bringing prohibition, largely, you know, Women's Christian Temperance Union.
Right.
Was replaced at the end of prohibition by women's groups who felt that their children were more in danger from prohibition than from alcohol. You know, now we have it where if you get arrested in possession of marijuana, sometimes you, if you're a young kid, you can't get student loans.
Right.
You get a criminal record, it's hard time to get, you know, jobs. So that What we really need is families. Once we see, and we're coming closer to there, but we're not there yet, and it'll probably take another 10 or 15 years, but once we see families, particularly mothers, say that this, you know, my child smoking pot and, you know, it's more dangerous for him or her to run into the police and get a record and go to jail than it is for them to smoke pot, and that when you keep it underground, you can't teach successfully harm reduction, and the information that's put out is biased in order to keep it. So what I'm saying is that as a society, we will be trying to work on the embedded fear about these drugs as one-way tickets to destruction. General Barry McCaffrey, who was the drug czar.
Yeah, fuck him, too.
For a while. You know, he was, I was at a seminar with him just the other day.
Oh.
And he was saying how much progress he's made that they don't talk about, you know, the war on drugs anymore. He thinks the war is a terrible metaphor. For him, a better metaphor is cancer. Drugs are cancer. And
well, give me cancer, Jesus. Give me cancer.
You know, well, I said, it's more like allergies. You know, the cancer analogy is not right because that implies that everybody's getting hurt who uses drugs. It's just a matter of degree because it's a fundamental poison. But if you think about it as allergies, like peanut allergies or aspirin allergies, substances will knock off, kill some people, but in general, most people can do them fine. And if we think about it that way, and if we start acknowledging the benefits, and from the 60s, we still have this idea that you do drugs, you drop out of society. You do drugs, you reject the values of society. And that there's this whole social split. So there's still just a lot of this fighting the battles of the 60s. Symbolic politics. And that's where Obama is sort of out of that. He's not a baby boomer. He's from that kind of, you know, 60s generation. So I think that we will have, eventually, therapeutic use of psychedelics. I should point out, though, that the situation with marijuana, ironically, is that we are making more progress with scientific research into therapeutic use of psychedelics, even LSD, than we are with marijuana. And the reason is because the government, the National Institute on Drug Abuse, has a monopoly on the supply of marijuana that you can use in research. We have our own independent sources of LSD, MDMA, psilocybin, all these other drugs. The NIDA has a monopoly only on marijuana, and if you want to make it into a medicine, they make it very difficult for you to get it. They delay, and they have terrible quality, and you need your own independent source of supply. So as long as the government has a monopoly on marijuana, we're not going to... No, there hasn't been a single privately funded study into the therapeutic use of marijuana in over 40 years. So we're trying to do that. MAPS is the organization that has, for the last, since 2001, with Professor Lyle Craker at UMass Amherst, we've tried to break the government monopoly. And a lot of things are coming to a head. We won an administrative law judge recommendation to the DEA in February 2007. And it was one of the last things the Bush administration, the DEA under Bush, did before they flunk out of office on January 14th is that they rejected, after doing nothing for 2 years, they rejected the application of the recommendation of the DEA administrative law judge that it would be in the public interest for us to get permission to have our own marijuana production facility, and then we'd work just with FDA. So we're trying. The Obama administration has said that they will stop the raids in medical marijuana states, the DEA federal raids going in there. Whether they will permit research to start is the big frontier for medical marijuana. And actually, Monday, the DEA lawyers submit their final response to our briefs. And on May 1, the final ruling of the DEA rejecting the recommendation to give us a license goes into effect unless we either get a new hearing or the Obama administration convinces the DEA to just reverse it. But there is about to be a new drug czar. There's new people at the Department of Justice, but it's still the Bush holdovers at DEA. There's not a new head of the DEA yet. So we're in a race for time. But what will be happening is that more and more states are going to be passing medical marijuana laws because they know that the federal system is hopelessly blocked. People see other people benefiting from marijuana. The public is getting educated. So we're moving in the right direction. The support for legalization of marijuana is up to like 40%. It's been climbing about 1 point a year for the last 15, 20 years. And it gets, you know, even higher in places like California. But we've got a long way to go. So I think that we need to really focus on doing the best we can with the medical use, wherever we can, to do the research, to deal with the fears, to replace the fears with hopes. That's why we have one track that we've talked about, which is MDMA for post-traumatic stress disorder. But we have a whole other track of research, which is psychedelics to help people at the end of life who are scared of death. So it's everybody. It's anxiety associated with end-of-life issues. And that's how we were able to start the first study of LSD therapeutic use in over 35 years. That's in Switzerland, with end-of-life issues. That's how we were able to start the first psychedelic research at Harvard since Leary got kicked out in 63, and a student of his stayed till 66. And 66 was the last psychedelic research at Harvard. So we've just recently helped start a study with MDMA for cancer patients, advanced stage cancer patients with anxiety.
Well, I
and
think
there's psilocybin studies.
I think there's a tremendous amount of medicinal value to virtually every drug that is traditionally considered recreational. And before we close out, because we're getting close to the end of the hour, and I want to thank you for talking with us and enlightening us with all of what's going on in your world. My question and my final question is this. You mentioned President Obama. He has said that we need to look at science and not ideology,
yes.
And he has made a number of very positive rhetorical statements with regards to drugs and the drug war. But yet we're still having difficulties in states that have medical marijuana laws on their books. And President Obama, in that town hall meeting, made a very nasty, snarky remark about the online community and marijuana smokers in general, and they did a tremendous amount of work putting him in the White House. Do you think that he has jeopardized a lot of his following by being dismissive and
No, not at all. I mean, I think that, I was watching that press conference, and, the internet press conference, and it was about the economy, and it was really good that the marijuana advocates got so many people to comment about that. But, he was asked, will marijuana help solve the financial crisis? He should have said, it's probably about $15 billion a year if we legalize with tax revenue and offset criminal justice system expenditures. And while $15 billion is nowhere near what we need for our health of our economic system, it's not nothing. Instead he said, no, it won't help. So, but you have to realize is that McCain got a lot of votes. It just was not enough. A landslide.
Just not enough.
It was just not enough. So there's a lot of issues he's got. He has come out and he has said he's stopping the DEA raids on medical marijuana states. He's going to leave that to the states. The key issue for him he's against. So he's been supportive of some of these changes, like the Rockefeller laws going down, the mandatory minimum.
But for a guy who has admitted to smoking marijuana and snorting cocaine, obviously he must understand when he looks at himself in the mirror that activity did not retard his intellectual growth or keep him from being elected president of the United States. But had he been caught doing those drugs back in his younger days, there's absolutely no question that he would be where he would not be where he is now. So there, to me, I see a certain hypocrisy with
no,
Obama
no.
When
I think,
when it
I think
comes
that
to drugs.
What I see in you is a certain impatience.
I'm 59 years old.
Okay, I'm going back to Israel in a week. I'm going to be meeting with the Minister of Health and various people about their medical marijuana program. And one of the people I'm meeting with is always joking about, well, how's the Messiah doing? Meaning Obama.
Right.
So he's just barely in office. He did not win in a massive landslide. And he's making changes. So I think we need to give him some time. And the signals are right. But in terms of drug policy, the big question is going to be, will the Obama administration overrule the last minute efforts of the Bush DEA to block medical marijuana research?
Well, let's hope he does.
And we will see. And I think that, drug policy is not his top priority. He's not spouting the rhetoric of culture war. There's a great story. Maybe we can end it like this. There's a great story of Franklin Roosevelt where a bunch of people go talk to him about an issue, try to persuade him. And he says, all right, you know, I agree with you. Now go out and make me do it. You know, go out and build the constituency that is so strong that, you know, you force me to do it.
Well, I think that
give me political,
I think that constituency.
Give me political cover.
Yeah, well, I think the political cover actually exists now. The constituency that made removing the prohibitions against marijuana his top question on government.org when he asked everyone. I think that constituency is saying, you know, is trying to force his hand, and I'm just hoping that he has the intelligence and the compassion and the humanity to understand that we are making that plea and having very high hopes, I guess is the proper term, high hopes that he'll listen to us and make some changes. So I'm going to give you, I'll give you the last 2 minutes, Rick, and we'll close out from there.
Well, you know, the idea of science over ideology, that's the repudiation of the whole Bush doctrine of, you know, we're going to cram stuff down your throats, and if the science gets in the way, we're going to squash the science. So I think that, though, we have to make a case. We in the community that sees that prohibition is counterproductive and that there are great benefits when these drugs are used wisely. We have to respond to the fears of parents. We have to respond to the existence of massive misinformation about the risks of these drugs. And we have to show that we can lead mainstream lives and that these drugs can help people lead the, whatever kind of lives that they want to. And I think we have to be thinking in terms of, 20-year plans. And at the same time, you know, the impatience that you're exhibiting is good. It's like a fundamental sense of outrage. It's a sense of injustice. But that we have to be willing to let people back down from their positions slowly and gradually. And you push too fast and you get people hardened in their positions and you end up taking longer.
Well, that could very well be true, and it's going to be the efforts of people like you and others that are going to help that to become a reality. So I want
to, and you too, for bringing this to the attention of your listeners.
Well, I hope they enjoyed it. I certainly did. It was great speaking with you again.
Yeah,
and,
but let me just say that if anybody wants to check out our website, it's MAPSmaps.org. We're in dire need of new members. Membership is available through the website. We also have a free email update that goes out once a month about our projects. We have our MAPS bulletins. This issue is coming out as a couple times a year. This is a special themed issue on psychedelics and ecology. So it gets back to this sort of psychedelic mystical experience and how that leads to trying to find a better harmony with nature. And, you know, our studies are not supported by the government yet. They're not supported by the pharmaceutical industry. They're not supported yet by the major foundations. They're just supported by individuals who care. And so, you know, joining MAPS and other organizations helps empower us. And so we couldn't do it without our, in combination with, we have about 1,500 members. You know, about 20 of them give most of the money. So I just want to encourage people to check out our website. And if anybody wants to write to me, I'm at rick@maps.org. I'm kind of swimming in email, so it might take me a while.
Well, I made a point at the top of the hour introducing you as our special guest this evening. I made a point of discussing MAPS. It's the number one link on the opiumden.net website. And we hope that everybody enjoyed speaking with you this evening. I know I did. And again, thank you very much, Rick, and have a very nice evening.
Yeah, and I look forward to one day having this conversation when opium's legal.
Well, you and me both, brother. You and me both.
And I hope we haven't scared off a bunch of people by saying that.
No, I don't think so. I think you'd be surprised at the number of people out there who whether they do recreational drugs or not, and there's probably 40 million or so that do, there are a significant number of people who do not that are lessening their objections and overcoming their fears. And we just hope that, from my perspective, I hope we can accelerate that and keep moving forward as opposed to in reverse.
Yeah, that's a great sentiment.
Okay, Rick, thanks again, and shalom.
Sure, thank